Hi everyone, welcome to Journeys with PDA Coffee Chat podcast, where we seek connection, community, and co-regulation while discussing all things PDA.
Welcome to the Journeys with PDA Coffee Chat podcast. I'm Carissa.
And I'm Heather. And today we are going to be talking with our special guest, Dr. Gina Foreman, and this will be our part two in the series with her.
Today we're going to be talking about medications and some medical conditions. We just want to clarify that we are not giving medical advice or prescribing any medications or any treatments. This is for informational purposes, and it's very important that you consult your own medical provider when it comes to treatments and medications.
Welcome back, everybody, and thank you, Gina, for being here with us again.
Hi, it's very nice to be here with you again. I'm excited to talk to you both tonight.
So we learned so many fascinating things last time, and so I'm really excited to dive in and learn so much more.
Awesome. Well, I had something I wanted to follow up on from the last discussion that we had, which was surrounding labs that are necessary for monitoring medications. We talked a little bit about the liver and how it metabolizes drugs, and we talked briefly also about albumin and how that lab value sometimes varies in people depending on their nutritional status, if they have liver disease and things like that. But I think a broader discussion about labs is also really important, especially because the population, especially the kids that we're talking about here, are PDAers. It is so difficult sometimes to overcome the demand of medical care and also the sensory issues at play when you're having blood drawn, and it's stressful. I mean, even many adults struggle with having blood drawn for labs, and you know, that's something significant to consider. And I do want to say just briefly why we do get certain labs. And so one is because of the liver metabolism. Some drugs, or many drugs, as I described the last time, they're metabolized through the liver. And also some of them can be damaging to the liver. If you have, you know, higher than normal amounts of that drug in your system, sometimes they can be damaging to the liver. It's not always a common phenomenon, but it does happen. One drug that's more notorious for liver damage that some of you may all be aware of is acetaminophen. And that's an over-the-counter drug that you could just go to the drugstore and buy, or pharmacy or whatever. And that one can be damaging to the liver. That's one that everybody knows about. But we do monitor patients' liver enzymes, their bilirubin levels, their albumin. These are all part of what we call a comprehensive metabolic panel, or CMP. You may see that ordered pretty routinely if you get annual labs done. Like a liver panel. Some places will, if you just want to do the liver panel, you'll do that and get those labs that I just described. But those are also important for us to monitor for certain medications. And another organ that is of concern sometimes with medications are your kidneys. So a lot of medications, especially if they're ones that are not metabolized through your liver, a lot of times those are eliminated in your urine via your kidneys. Your kidneys' primary function is to filter out your blood. And so when those medications, those drugs are in your bloodstream, your kidneys do the job of filtering those out. And sometimes medications can be damaging to the kidneys, but most of the time, our primary concern as pharmacists is that if your kidneys are not functioning at the level that they're supposed to be, then we need to reduce the dosage of medications for that purpose. And we do that sometimes with people that have, you know, liver disease as well, for those medications that are metabolized through the liver. That also happens. But especially for things like antibiotics, for example, This obviously comes into play with people that actually have kidney disease. It's more common in the elderly or older population too. You know, as we age, our organs just have normal aging and tend to not function quite as well as when we were younger. And so these are all things from a pharmacist perspective that we're looking at whenever we're getting those lab results. And of course, your physicians are also looking at those things. It's just that the focus, from my perspective, is always on the medications, mm-hmm. right? But all of these things are important to monitor. And from a drug-specific perspective, there are some medications that we give that we can actually do what we call drug concentrations, but it's your blood levels of the drugs in your system, right? And there's not too many medications that we do that for, but some that are important that might impact the community that we are in would be things like anti-seizure drugs. Some of those have a very, I talked about the therapeutic index or therapeutic mm-hmm. window, right? Mm-hmm. That safe zone that we try to stay in. We get drug levels on a lot of the anti-seizure drugs to make sure that they're in that effective zone, primarily with seizures, because you're really looking at seizure control, but also the safety aspect, because sometimes that safety margin is, you know, pretty narrow. So that's one thing I wanted to at least throw out there for everybody listening.
Getting those labs drawn when you have sensory kiddos, it's always a ton of fun, but necessary.
Yeah, so yeah, important.
Like, honestly, any medical intervention, like my daughter has had a lot of ear infections mm-hmm. and has had two ENT procedures done. And so her ears, like she's so incredibly sensitive mm-hmm. with those ears. And that is a big struggle point for us. Like honestly, it would probably be easier for us to have blood drawn than to do an ear exam.
Oh.
That's when, you know, having that communication maybe beforehand with the medical provider, just letting them know about your child's sensory issues. And if you happen to be in a medical facility that has like a child life specialist, you know, these are people who are trained to kind of act as an intermediary between what's happening and kind of translating that into very kid-friendly language and making things set up to where it's very kid-friendly. And it wouldn't, you know, it perfectly okay to advocate for your child and ask for those kinds of services as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too, is definitely make sure that when you're going in to have a blood draw, make sure that they know the situation and, you know, if they have high anxiety, that they are nervous. And sometimes just even like sitting in the waiting room can make it worse. So mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, if you communicate those needs, they want everything to go smooth. And so maybe you can sit in the exam room and wait there with, you know, with a tablet, and so that your child's not becoming more anxious. Sometimes you can wait out in the car and they'll let you know. So there are mm-hmm. options on how to make things like that a lot smoother. I have found that people who are going to be drawing blood on children often, they're quicker, they're more used to it, and it goes a lot easier rather than just going into like a lab somewhere. And so we always do it, you know, at the children's hospital, and they're really good at that. But I think it's good that you brought it up, because that's going to be a challenge that as parents, we're going to have to figure out how to handle. And so it helps to know, like, why do I need to tackle this challenge? And why is it, you know, so important when, you know, it's going to be very, like, it's going to be difficult. But it's so important to do. And I think it really I'm really thankful that you're here to help kind of break this down and explain, you know, explain all of these, like all of the pieces. And it calms me, makes me less anxious when I can know that, like, why are we doing this? That always mm-hmm. helps me. And then I like to be able to give that why to our kids. So.
Yeah, I agree. And everything you said about advocating to make things easier, I do all those same things. We never wait in the waiting room anywhere. We always wait in my van, in the parking lot. And I have the nurse call me whenever our room is ready and we go straight into the exam room. She always has her tablet with her. Like, we do all of those things. And I know also in the era of COVID, there's been a lot more accessible lab draw stations, like particularly drive-through labs have become a thing more often. And so, like, if you have access to that, you don't even have to go into a building. You can just sit in your vehicle. You know, that might be way more comforting for some kids, because, like, as far as safe places go, you know, our minivan is a safe place for my daughter.
My PCM has one of those.
Not even having to get out of her booster seat in the minivan and having labs done, that would be a lot more accessible than trying to go into the office, because they expect the worst mm-hmm. whenever they're going into a doctor's office. No matter how much you explain to them what's going to happen, it's anxiety producing.
It is. It absolutely is. And, you know, the medical facility that I go to, the complex, they have a drive-through lab, and it's a converted firehouse. It was an old firehouse. So you drive in, the door goes behind you, you mm-hmm. do your labs, and then you drive out in the front. And that's, it's like, amazing. Boom, 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 boom. It's fantastic. Yep. Fantastic. Yeah. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. For all of the negative things that being in the pandemic brought, at least there were a few more things that were made more accessible mm-hmm. To people, because we were practicing social distancing. Well, guess what? Our PDAers sometimes are automatically social distancing, right? Because they don't want to be a part of
right whatever. Yes. Yes. Yeah,
like, if you have demand avoidance, guess right. what? Well, this is made for you, right?
We've heard that so much that, like, our PDAs just started because they couldn't go anywhere. They weren't made to go anywhere because of the pandemic. They just started, you know, flourishing at home. And yeah. So, yeah. Gotta love those drive-by labs. Okay. I'm coming through.
Anytime that you can get ready, go somewhere. Here comes Heather. Not get out of the car. That is the best.
Mm-hmm. Yes. 100%.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you for filling us in and giving us some more comprehensive information about why labs are so important.
You're welcome. Another thing that I think we probably should discuss, or that I should go into a little bit, is how different neurotransmitters work. If we're going to talk about medications that are used for, you know, different mental health conditions or how your brain works in general, I think a little bit of an overview of that before we go and talk about the medications, because it's so hard to talk about the medicines if we don't understand what's happening mm-hmm. and what the neurotransmitters are like in your brain. And so I'm just going to give a brief description of that. First, broadly talking about your nervous system, it's broken down into two parts, the sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. And those two work in opposite directions generally. And so your sympathetic nervous system is what you tend to think about as your activating nervous system. That's where you get into your fight, flight, freeze, fawn responses. You know, that's the threat response. You know, if you're being chased by a tiger, your sympathetic nervous system is in full force, right? And your parasympathetic nervous system is kind of called the rest and digest. It's a nickname that's given to it. And that's where, you know, all of your kind of safer functions, like, you have to feel safe to be in your parasympathetic nervous system. And the biggest part of the parasympathetic nervous system is mediated, 75% of your parasympathetic nervous system is mediated by the vagus nerve, which many of you are probably familiar with. There's a lot of work being done on different ways to stimulate the vagus nerve and that response, especially to stimulate that to get out of the sympathetic part, right? Like if your threat response is activated, then you're in fight, flight, freeze, fawn. There's a lot of work being done on the vagus nerve since that is the majority of your parasympathetic nervous system and trying to activate that to slow the sympathetic nervous system down. So that's broadly how things work. And then, you know, you have your neurons. Those are the cells. Neurons are the cells of your nervous system. And those neurons communicate to each other by sending neurotransmitters. And the common neurotransmitters, many of you probably are familiar with what these are, but they're things like epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin, histamine, acetylcholine. And so I'm just going to kind of briefly describe each one. I'm not going to go in big detail. I don't think we need to do any of that for the scope of this. But one thing to think about with your parasympathetic nervous system, too, is that that is when you can access your thinking brain, right? We talk a little bit about that being your thinking brain. When your threat response is activated and you're in fight, flight, freeze, fawn, you're not able to access your thinking brain because that's mediated by your parasympathetic nervous system. And the primary neurotransmitter for that is acetylcholine. So that neurotransmitter it's implicated in a lot of diseases. One of the most popular one that we think about is Alzheimer's disease. And so a lot of the medications that we use to treat Alzheimer's disease increase acetylcholine transmission in your brain. And so again, that's a parasympathetic nervous system neurotransmitter. Also things like the ability to sleep, the ability to digest your food, to get deep rest. Those things are all happening when you're primarily in your parasympathetic nervous system. And acetylcholine is part of that, a primary neurotransmitter for that. If we talk about the sympathetic nervous system, these are the things that you think of if your threat response is activated, you're facing a tiger, or your anxiety is just sky high. That's your stress response. Mm-hmm. And so we think of cortisol. Many people think of cortisol being the stress hormone. Realistically, cortisol is the precursor for three of the neurotransmitters that are part of that sympathetic nervous system. Cortisol is the precursor for dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. And so these are the neurotransmitters that are going all over your body and having all of these actions. They're sending blood to your muscles so you can run away from the tiger. You know, they're sending a bunch of blood to your brain and your heart and your lungs so that you can prepare to run away. And so dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, those are all things that are going to be targeted by a lot of the medications that I'll discuss in a little bit. Those are your catecholamines, broadly, that's what they're called, that group. And those are your primary mediators for the sympathetic nervous system. Some other neurotransmitters that we think about that are important to discuss are serotonin. And so people think of that as like the happy neurotransmitter, right? It tends to, whenever you increase serotonin, you tend to have a less depressed state, right? We think of low serotonin being a more depressed state, even though it's not quite that simple in your body. That's generally how we think of that, serotonin being the happy hormone, not hormone, but neurotransmitter, sorry. And also, interestingly, serotonin, melatonin is derived from serotonin. And so if you don't have an adequate supply of serotonin, which its precursor is tryptophan, which is an amino acid. We think about tryptophan. I know I listened to your podcast with Suzanne Gunn that you did, and she talked a little bit about this, about how she was eating turkey. Uh-huh. I thought this was hilarious. I was like, she woke up in the middle of the night and she ate turkey, which gave her tryptophan, which then was converted to serotonin and melatonin in her body so that she would be triggered to sleep. And I was like, that's so brilliant, because tryptophan levels are elevated in turkey specifically. Mm-hmm. That's why everybody has the post-Thanksgiving dinner coma, right? And so anyway, I putting that all together, it's just funny. But it also points out how many things in your body are connected, mm-hmm. and how very difficult sometimes it is to get a body in balance. And that's a lot of times what we're trying to do with these medications, is to correct an imbalance. But as I'll talk about here in a few minutes, a lot of the medications target so many different receptors. You might be putting one thing back in balance, but then the scale's tilted, right? Mm-hmm. And so something else might be out of balance, or it might be hitting a receptor that you didn't want, or that you're having unwanted side effects. So these are all things that we need to think about. Some other ones that just briefly I will probably mention would be like histamine, which everybody's probably pretty familiar with. Histamine being an inflammatory neurotransmitter. If you have any kind of inflammatory process happening, histamine levels are generally high. It's an activating kind of like there's a problem, histamine release is going to happen. But then there's also people in the community that have things like mast cell activation syndrome. And that's like abnormally high levels of histamine response, or like an overactive histamine response. And so there's just so many individual things to consider whenever we're talking about all of the neurotransmitters and the medications that we're using, that there's really no cut and dry here. But hopefully that's a good enough description that we can start talking about the medications.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is, and I think that's also like, when we go back to the labs, you know, knowing, you know, yes, we're going to do this medication for this, but it goes back to that. Is this going to throw something else, you know, off kilter, and why labs are so important?
Mm-hmm. For sure. At this point, I can kind of give, there's a lot of medications that would be commonly used in our community for different reasons. And, I can kind of start talking about some of those, but I want you guys to, you know, chime in with your questions and things as I'm going through this. But just to start off with, I think most people are pretty familiar with the SSRI class. A lot of people, that stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And so those are drugs like sertraline or Zoloft, citalopram, escitalopram, paroxetine, fluoxetine. They've been around for quite a while. And honestly, they were developed because a lot of the older drugs that were used, SSRIs are primarily used for depression and anxiety. But they were created because a lot of the older drug classes that we have, like MAOIs, monoamine oxidase inhibitors, tricyclic antidepressants, they hit so many of these different neurotransmitters that they cause so many different side effects. And so people did not find them very tolerable. And broadly speaking, in general, for all of these medications over time, more medication classes have been developed as the needs arisen, right? Like a lot of the older drugs that we have, especially in the antipsychotic class, if we talk about those, they hit so many different receptors, and it causes so many different shifts and side effects that are unwanted. And so more new drugs are developed over time to kind of be a more tailored approach and hit fewer of these different neurotransmitter receptors so that people have fewer side effects. And so SSRIs are considered fairly clean in the fact that they increase serotonin, and then also in a lesser degree, norepinephrine, and very weakly on dopamine. Primarily we think of these as serotonergic drugs. And so SSRIs because they're more tailored and they don't hit as many receptors, they're generally pretty well tolerated. But something else that you need to think about with all of these drugs is that, and this isn't just for SSRIs, it's for any of the, we can say neurological type drugs, they hit different receptors at varying potencies, varying degrees. Mm. And so they're not like equivalent. Like they might like, they might be in the same drug class because they're similar, but they impact people differently because their potency for different neurotransmitters is slightly different. And so one thing about the SSRIs is if like, for example, if I were diagnosed with an anxiety disorder and I was going to start on an SSRI, let's say I start sertraline and we start up titrating the dose and I start getting migraines, because that's a pretty common side effect. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to get migraines with one of the other SSRIs. Mm-hmm. And so it's reasonable to try other SSRIs to see if the effect would happen. And so that's why in a lot of our literature, it's like, okay, you try an SSRI first, and if you fail one, it's reasonable to try another one, you know, especially one that might be structurally different.
This is like, it's so fascinating. I love getting to hear all of this because I think that it like that really like explains why I might take a specific medication and it's going to work really great for me and I'm not going to have issues with it. And then, you know, my best friend takes the same medication and does have all the side effects. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on, why would it cause the side effects? And I think then it's like, oh, it's going to do that to me. But it really just goes back into like your body and how you process it. And I also think like a really, really important point to take from that is, if you take the one medication and it doesn't work for you and you are having the side effects, then it is very reasonable to make sure that your doctor knows so that they can work on finding something that could work better for you. Mm-hmm. And I think there's sort of this idea of, well, I took the one and it just didn't work. So nothing works. And so then like that also ties into your, you know, like blood work and different things like that. So, I think like, I'm thinking about like, you know, all of the trial and error that we did trying to find something that worked with my kids. And also this really explains too, why, you know, our doctor is like, hey, I think you need this one, but also this one. And when you're talking about, you know, things can get off or this one's going to hit these certain transmitters, but it's not reaching over here. And so you're going to need something to help balance in different places. And I think that's really important to realize because when you are a mama and you're like trained to help your child, and the doctor's like, well, I think that they need three different prescriptions, that can feel really intimidating. And so I think that this is just amazing information to help us understand why a doctor might want you to try something different or why you need to have two different medications. And I feel like I'm learning so many things I didn't even know.
Yeah, that was really great, Carissa, to bring up the fact that there are some things in medicine that are fairly clear-cut and well-studied, and you can see replicable results with the same medication in the same, like in a large number of people, right? If I think about giving just generically a blood pressure medicine to someone, their blood pressure will lower if I give this thing, right? Like that, like I can pretty definitively say when I start a blood pressure, or not when I start it, but when I say, yeah, this person's going to start on blood pressure medicine, that their blood pressure will lower. To what degree, I don't know necessarily off the cuff, but it will lower. Now, it's not necessarily the same as starting something like an SSRI. I can't tell you exactly, you know, with 100% certainty what's going to happen. And honestly, it's just so individualized. I think that's what I want to say, is that especially for medications for mental health, it's so individualized. And that even though some of these drugs are in the same drug class, they are not exactly the same. They don't have the exact same effects. And so trial and error, and being a little bit patient with it, mm-hmm. and not despairing that just because one drug worked, that there won't be something that will, you know, I think those are all amazing points to make here. And I think that that can't be understated. And the individual nature of things. I can't just say, oh, you were diagnosed with PMDD, you should go start sertraline, because that's not going to be right for everyone. You know what I'm saying? Like there's not just this cut and dry thing where, oh, well, my friend takes Zoloft or sertraline and she's doing great on that, so I need to get on that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it just, those kind of generalizations that people sometimes make, they're not realistic. And holding on to things like that is sometimes more hurtful than helpful.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the genetic testing that you can get for psychiatric drugs?
I personally feel that more information is good. Because from a safety perspective in particular, if you know that you're deficient in a specific enzyme, then you should not take medications that are metabolized by that enzyme if you have other options. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my point, because this group is very heterogeneous. The group of psychiatric or neuro medications, mm-hmm. they're not all the same. They're not all created equal. They don't all go through the same metabolism pathways. There's so much variability there that having that information is very helpful to avoid medications that you very likely know on the front end that they would cause side effects mm-hmm. or complications. And so I think that kind of information is valuable. Now, you might find out things that maybe you were happy you're not knowing, or like, oh, I'm a poor metabolizer of 2D6 and I really didn't care to know that, but maybe it's kind of important, mm-hmm. you know? So I personally am on the side of having more information.
Sure.
It helps us and you to make more informed mm-hmm. decisions.
Yeah. It's not necessarily.
Sometimes you don't, you know.
Oh, sorry, Heather and I, we always get too excited. Okay.
We do this. There tends to be a lag sometimes, and we end up talking over each other. Go ahead, Carissa.
I was just going to say, you know, doing that sort of testing, I'm assuming, is also not like a guarantee. It's not like, oh, okay, now we know for sure this is exactly what you need. It's more just of like reference points and sort of like a guide, right?
Well, I think a guide for sure. Now, it does tell you, mm-hmm. these reports tell you whether someone is a high metabolizer, a normal metabolizer, or poor metabolizer of certain medications, depending. And specifically what I'm trying to reference here is if you have testing done on your CYP P450 enzymes, those liver enzymes that are metabolizing medications. Like if you know that you're a poor metabolizer of a certain drug, it's generally wise to stay away from drugs that are metabolized by that enzyme because your effects will not be as reliable as if you were a normal metabolizer and could lead to side effects that are undesirable. And the drug could be less effective because it's not being metabolized. Sometimes when drugs are metabolized, there's something called prodrugs. Like if you take a drug, sometimes it's not the active drug that you're taking. Your liver has to activate it. That enzyme activates the drug to make it effective in your body. So if you're taking a drug that then you're a poor metabolizer and it's not getting metabolized, the drug's not working. Right?
Wow.
And so that's why having this kind of inflammation is important.
Yeah.
So I am in favor of it, but there is also the barriers. Like obviously it's a financial barrier. Yes. Unless your insurance is going to cover the majority of this, it's very expensive. So affordability is still a significant concern. You also might have a physician that's not comfortable ordering it. You might have to go see a specialist. You might have to go see a geneticist. And so I'm not necessarily saying, yeah, go out and do this for everybody. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying if you're presented with the opportunity to do it and you're able to do it, then I think that information is valuable.
Oh, that's so helpful to know.
Mm-hmm. I'm like having thoughts of like, how close are we to having our entire genome mapped and having designer medications, you know, specific to our DNA? We're probably a lot closer than what most people think we are.
Yeah, it is really amazing to see how far this has come. Mm-hmm. Just in the last 10 years, it's become a lot more commonplace. And hopefully in the next 10 years, it'll continue to become more commonplace. It really is exciting. And like, it gives us something new to learn and have that information. I mean, to have that level of insight mm-hmm. is something that people 50 years ago could not have dreamed of, you know? So I think it's kind of amazing, really.
You know, if we could tell Crook and Watson this was going to happen, you know, they just like, oh, guess what? In so many years, we're going to be able to do XYZ. All right. I can nerd out so much on this because this is just absolutely fascinating. We've talked quite a bit about the mental health kind of medications that people are prescribed. What about, you know, branching off from that? What about things like, medications that are prescribed because of co-occurring conditions that our kiddos might have, like ADHD. I get a lot, when I was teaching, I would get a lot from parents like, you know, I don't want to put them on medication because I'm giving them speed and they're hyperactive. So can you help us address some of those misunderstandings about why we're giving someone a stimulant or not we. Your child's medical provider might suggest a stimulant for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
It's really interesting. I've noticed that there's a significant stigma around ADHD medications, in particular stimulants, as you've pointed out. And I don't know how it came to be necessarily, other than the fact that they are a controlled substance. And obviously, you know, being on them, it's a little bit, you know, a little bit more hoops documentation, you know, from our standpoint, to be on a stimulant. But I think it comes from a place of lack of information, mm-hmm. lack of insight, primarily, and also fear. Like, if you find out that your child's neurodivergent, if you find out they're ADHD and they're having so many struggles and you're confronted with so many new things, I mean, this goes for anything, right? Anything that might be something new or overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It sometimes can feel scary. It sometimes can feel scary to start any medication. And like, as a pharmacist, I'm probably a terrible offender because I'll be the one that'll be suffering from a headache all day long. And I'll tell my husband and he'll be like, well, did you take ibuprofen? And I'm like, no. And so like these are just things that we do. We're human, right? And this is a human experience. And also, I think it also comes from a place of well-intentioned inner protective nature, right? We all, you know, we're moms. We have that mama bear instinct. And we don't want to potentially give anything that would be harmful to our children. I'm not saying that would be harmful, but any drug, mm-hmm. I am not necessarily just saying stimulants here. Any drug, there is benefit and there is risk. Again, we talked about the window. Like, you know, when someone starts a new medication, I can't promise you're not going to have an allergic reaction to it. Mm-hmm. You know, like the odds might be 1 in 100,000, but it's possible, you know? And so that's, you have to make that risk versus benefit analysis anytime that you start something, anytime that you do something. The likelihood of benefit usually for most medical treatments far outweighs the risks, which is why we do them. That's how they become the standard of care, mm-hmm. right? Is because the benefits far outweigh the risks. Now, if we're specifically talking about stimulants, these medications work on increasing dopamine and norepinephrine in the brain. But it goes to certain areas of the brain. In particular, if you took methylphenidate, I'll use this example. If you took methylphenidate, you would have increased levels of norepinephrine in your prefrontal cortex. That's working for executive dysfunction. Okay? That's like that specific thing that's happening there, that is improving your child's executive dysfunction or whoever is using methylphenidate. And so that's a huge part of ADHD. Now, norepinephrine and dopamine, whenever they go there, they're going to multiple different parts of the brain. That's just a very specific mechanism that is something that's happening when you're using methylphenidate for ADHD. And it doesn't mean that there aren't also things that are side effects from the stimulants. Like, for example, because of the increased norepinephrine and dopamine, it decreases appetite. Remember, we're increasing these sympathetic mm-hmm. neurotransmitters, and that's your threat response. When you're threatened, you're not going to stop and have a snack when you're running away from a tiger. Okay, so that is a significant side effect for people who are on stimulants long-term, is that sometimes weight loss can happen. Now, sometimes that's desirable. I mean, it would be in my case, but I'm not saying that it would be for a child necessarily. We're a lot more worried about children mm-hmm. on stimulants because of growth and development being so critical in childhood. Now, the weight loss does not happen in everyone. Sometimes some children that are on stimulants for ADHD don't eat a lot during the day, but whenever they're not taking the medication in the evening, when they're at home, they eat a huge dinner. And so they make up mm-hmm. for the calories that they didn't eat during the day. These are things that are observable and happen, but obviously this is not blanket medical advice for anybody. I'm just saying that this is how the drug works. And obviously individual conditions have to be considered, right?
Sure.
So that's my overall thought on stimulants. And every drug that exists, people will take it. And the drugs that we've developed for medicinal use have a purpose. There are benefits, mm-hmm. there are risks. You just have to weigh them.
That was such a great description because, that's always been one of my burning questions is I'm like, I don't understand how I have this child who's like literally going too fast and bouncing off the walls. But then you're telling me a stimulant, like, and honestly, it can be so overwhelming and so hard to be sitting in a doctor office with a child who's bouncing off the walls and to be able to ask these questions. And so then, you know, you really just have this misunderstanding and you're not getting the right information. And so to realize like, oh my gosh, that's coming into that front part of their brain. And that's why, you know, that's why it works. And, but it also comes back to that. This is why it's so important, that you have conversations with your medical providers mm-hmm. and say, I'm not really sure about this. And, this big, gigantic, long word that starts with meth sounds terrifying. Help me understand what's going on. And I think, you know, I know I can speak for me. I get nervous to ask those questions. And, so I think it's really helpful to be able to get into that, and why it works.
Yep. And as an adult medicated ADHDer, I can tell, I know exactly the moment my medication hits, because all of a sudden I can, and it's not like, oh, I can go and take off and just start doing all the things. It's not that at all. It's just that I can organize things. I can, in my head, you know, where you go back to that executive functioning, I can start, I have the momentum. I have the ability to focus and sit down and accomplish things. Whereas before, but you know, it was just all over. It was just, you know, everything is, I don't even know how to start. Yeah, it's funny that stuff. And thank goodness it's there so that Heather can focus and concentrate and do all the things.
Yes. So I have a big question. So I know anti-anxiety medications can be really helpful when you have anxiety. So we've already kind of talked about that and how those work. And so one of the things that I'm very curious about is something that is a mood stabilizer or an antipsychotic. And I think because the word antipsychotic is so intimidating. And so if you think about like, I'm going to give my child an antipsychotic, you know, it's like that same fear that comes with just not knowing. And so what are mood stabilizers? How does a mood stabilizer work? What, like, how's it impacting your brain and your body? How does it stabilize your mood?
Well, first of all, I want to say that the terms for these classes, like mood stabilizer, antipsychotic, these are terms that were made a very long time ago in medical literature. And again, like we just talked about stimulants for ADHD, I think that they're a little bit stigmatizing and misleading, because the class of mood stabilizers, for example, they're different drugs, different classes of drugs even. And they're all considered mood stabilizers because typically they're used for things like bipolar disorder or for people who have episodes of both mania and depression, mixed neurology, or multiple mental health problems, multiple conditions. And so I think that that name is very, I think they're both very misleading. Now, you know, the antipsychotic class was basically developed for things like schizophrenia. Like if we think back to so early drug development, that's initially, you know, psychosis. That's why these drugs were developed and hence why they have their names. But their use is so much more broad than just for schizophrenia. And so I think generally it's really hard to, like, we have labels on these things, but they aren't, it doesn't mean they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
Or used for all the same things. Like the number of off-label uses and just uses in general for antipsychotics is so broad, so broad. And so I think that this is a really nuanced discussion. And yes, it sounds scary. You know, I'm not going to say that it wouldn't, especially if I'm trying to imagine if I were uninformed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I try to imagine that when I say things, like if I were uninformed, it would sound scary, you know, it would. And I can relate to that, but also on my end, I'm realizing, like, please don't all just treat bipolar disorder. These all don't just treat schizophrenia. Like, there are so many different uses for medications. And over time, the list just keeps getting longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do, before I start talking about that in detail, I just want to say, too, that with antipsychotics, like I was talking about before with SSRIs, and the mood stabilizers, it goes for all of these. They hit so many different neurotransmitters that, again, they're not all the same. Just because they're in the same drug class, it doesn't mean they have the exact same effects on everything. And there's a lot of variability there. If you try one, it doesn't mean another one won't work. And in fact, that's pretty routine that, you know, you try multiple ones until you find what works. And that you don't have side effects that are intolerable, too. Mood stabilizers, I'll talk about that one first because there's fewer drugs. Generally, whenever we talk about those, we're talking about things like lithium or carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine or lamotrigine or Lamictal is the brand name on that one. Those four drugs are considered mood stabilizers. What I am saying is not an all-inclusive list. I will just throw that out there. Those are pretty common ones that are prescribed, and typically you see those for things like bipolar disorder. Most of those drugs will cover you for more broadly for things like mixed bipolar disorder, where there's manic and depressive episodes. But many times you're not going to have the desired response with just one medication, and the first one you try may or may not work. And so just real quickly with the mood stabilizers, in terms of effectiveness, lithium, for example, has been around for a long time. It's very effective, but it has a very narrow therapeutic window. So we have to do lithium-specific blood levels. And not to mention monitoring your kidney function and other things, because it is eliminated through your kidneys. And if you were to overdose on it, it can have bad impacts on your kidneys and your heart. And so we monitor lithium extremely closely, and that can be a barrier for people to have frequent blood draws, right? We've discussed that earlier. So that's one just caveat I want to say about that drug. And then things like carbamazepine and oxcarbazepine, those are used a lot for seizure control. And so a lot of people will probably be on those for seizure control. But let's say they have both bipolar disorder and epilepsy, then you could have one drug that's working for both things. And so the conversation has to be individualized and nuanced, and in an effort to try to consolidate medications, you know, that might be a reasonable option. And again, we do drug levels on that medication too, especially if we're looking at someone that has epilepsy or seizure disorder, because we want to make sure that it's at an effective dose. An interesting note about carbamazepine, which also makes it really hard and important to do drug levels on, is that I talked about enzymes, the liver enzymes. So carbamazepine is actually an enzyme inducer, and it's an auto inducer and induces its own metabolism. So you have, it increases the enzyme that eliminates it from your body. And so you have to do drug levels to make sure that your levels are still where they need to be, because they might change over time, right? And so that's a really unique thing about that drug.
What is the brand name of the drug you were?
The historical brand name for carbamazepine is Tegretol.
Oh, like I would have known that one.
But anyway.
Okay.
I try not to say a lot of brand names because
I couldn't link it in my head when you said it, and I wouldn't have ever been able to make that connection because I've never heard of that one either. So,
go ahead.
All of these, these medication names, I feel like someone just like picks letters out of a bag and like puts it together.
No.
And that's,
yes. Can I just say that when I started pharmacy school, it was like learning an entirely new language.
Yes.
And none of it phonetically makes sense.
No.
And it was just a bunch of letters jumbled together. And you're just like,
blah, blah, blah. I feel like it's a boggle game. You know, the boggle game where you're shaking it up and...
Yes. And when I go to the pharmacy and then they like... want to know what I'm picking up, and I'm just like, we know that I cannot see these words. I was like,
one that starts with an A and there's another one that starts with a G.
Yeah, that's what I do. The one that starts with a Q, and then they're like, oh, okay. So, anyways, I just had to mention that as we're like,
especially for us dyslexics and
people get
don't be a pharmacist if you're just like this. Just I'm just saying, it's hard enough if you don't have dyslexia. Don't torture yourself. Just don't.
Yeah, it's wildly confusing. And so as a dyslexic person, I very, very often, when I'm trying to talk to a medical provider about the meds, and they're just saying these words and they're like, I can't make any connections. I always just say, will you write that down for me? And so, you know, that's like one of those built-in accommodations for me is, I just need you to write that down. We do some of ours on Zoom and like, they'll type it for me so that I can kind of like,
I always I ask that they put it in the post-visit notes, post-appointment notes. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to adopt, especially my son who's on a list of medication, I make sure that I always have a list, like a hard copy in my wallet. And when they start asking me questions, I just hand them the list. I'm like, these are his current meds. And they go, oh,
yes,
I want to make a copy of this. And I go, okay, make a copy of that. That's fine. So... that way I never have to remember anything because Lord knows.
I always just take pictures of the prescription bottle because it'll have the name, it has the date, and it has the dose. And I will like slide my phone over and be like, okay, like I'm not telling you anything because I don't actually know what's happening. You just read the information and, but then also I know I'm giving correct information. So anyways, I sort of, drug us down a little rabbit hole there, but
I love this rabbit hole and I want to make comments about the rabbit hole and continue going down it. I love that you both do that and you both have different strategies for doing it. And there's a lot of different ways that you could do this. Like Heather has the list, right? Carissa takes pictures. What you can also do is actually bring your drug bottles with you to your appointments so you can show them what you're taking if it's not a cumbersome amount. If it's a lot, then the list makes a lot more sense. But I can't tell you how appreciative we are to have updated medication lists on people, especially if you come into the hospital or it's a hospital you don't normally go to or a new provider. That information is so incredibly important, especially if you see multiple prescribing doctors and that information is not easily accessible. I mean, that is so huge. And I want to say too, that another thing to add on that list is not only prescription drugs, but any over-the-counter supplements, vitamins, aspirin, ibuprofen, Tylenol. If you take any of those things routinely, you put that on the list too. And I know I emphasized this in the first podcast that we had, but the supplements and the over-the-counter drugs can interact with prescription drugs just as easily as any of the prescription drugs could interact with each other. Like one that comes to mind, especially for a lot of the serotonergic type drugs, is St. John's wort. Mm-hmm. If you take that and you take any kind of serotonergic drug, stop taking St. John's wort. And we also talked about something like grapefruit juice, you know, like you don't have to report on your medication list if you're drinking grapefruit juice, but also like just, it's not to be understated how important it is to have a complete list of everything that you're taking.
Yeah. And since we're just going down these little bunny trails here, I would like to just have a public service announcement. If you're taking Tylenol, please make sure that you're not taking multiple medications that have acetaminophen in it, because you can do severe damage to your body and not know it. I think it's called Tylenol toxicity. Did I get that right or make it up?
Yeah. Or Tylenol overdose.
People just don't realize how many things have acetaminophen in it, and they take, you know, acetaminophen on top of it, and you can do some real damage to your liver.
Liver. Yes. Yeah. It's really unfortunate. And I mean, particularly, so a lot of our pain medications that are prescription pain medications, things like hydrocodone, acetaminophen, oxycodone, acetaminophen. There are a lot of combo products that have acetaminophen in it. And you're right, if you're taking an over-the-counter acetaminophen containing product, like you need to look at everything, like cough and cold and allergy preparations. Many of them have acetaminophen in them too. So this is not just a single product thing that you need to worry about. And like, this is a wonderful PSA, because unfortunately acetaminophen toxicity is fairly common because, again, the therapeutic window on that is pretty narrow. For some people, it's only safe for them to have 2000 milligrams per day. The labeling on an over-the-counter bottle would tell you that you can take up to 4000 milligrams per day. But again, these things are individualized. And if you're predisposed to, you know, liver damage, then you're going to want to keep it at 2000 milligrams per day and not go up to 4000 milligrams per day. It's so important to read labels. It's so important to have complete medication lists. That's it, like, biggest PSA for the day, probably, on that.
Thank you for giving me this PSA time to PSA.
We're saving lives here.
Hey, yeah. All right. So going on, you know, some more questions that our community might have, with pathological demand avoidance, the driver of PDA is anxiety. And we have families who get asked by, like, maybe, you know, well-meaning extended family members, friends, that people who are connected with their family, that if anxiety is the driving force, then why don't you treat PDA with an anxiety drug? Which I know, like, for my son, he doesn't necessarily take an anti-anxiety medication. You know, there's other things that are kind of prescribed off-label that help support, you know, help calm that his brain. But can you talk a little bit about why just, you know, anti-anxiety medication is not given to somebody with, you know, anxiety as the forefront, as that, you know, driver of the train.
Or why it's not like the solve all solution. Because I think that that's sometimes the assumption is like, oh, just give them an anti-anxiety. The end.
Why can't they just take some Valium?
This is a really good question and also really nuanced because, first of all, there are no FDA-approved medications for the treatment of autism or pathological demand avoidance. Pathological demand avoidance is not in the DSM-5 in the United States, which is the diagnostic manual for mental health conditions, and thus there are no approved medications for either of these things. Okay. Now, if we talk about anxiety specifically, certainly there are medications that can be used for anxiety. But this conversation, again, is very nuanced. Most of our kiddos, it's not just anxiety that we're dealing with. We're dealing with a lot of co-occurring conditions and individual factors. And the question of medications is an incredibly individual discussion and conversation. And so I think there's two pieces that you would need to think about here. The first is that obviously you get the question from people, whether they're family, friends, whoever, well-meaning people mm-hmm. generally that are like, well, why can't you just, you know, put them on a medication and fix it? And it's like, well, it's not that easy. It's their neurobiology. They're made this way. Developmentally, they mm-hmm. are this way. And no matter what medication you give them, they're always going to be this way. It's their brain, but it's the way their brain is, right? Mm-hmm. A medication will not change that. Now, and so I think that's one piece, and it's the lack of education. Pathological demand avoidance is not something that is publicly talked about. It's not talked about in medicine, right? It's not in the DSM-5. Most medical professionals have no idea what it is. And so we're talking about a very niche thing, mm-hmm. you know, here. Unfortunately, it's niche. It should be mainstream. It's not. Not yet. Not yet. Right.
I believe in the power of yet.
Not yet. So that's one piece of this. The other is to talk about medication for anxiety specifically. You know, certainly the anxiety that our kids experience is debilitating at times, right? There are a lot of things that we can do to support that are not medication, but we can also use medications when they're necessary in consultation with your medical professionals. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to discount that. And, you know, I'm certainly pro-medication if the benefits outweigh the risks, right? And that's an individual discussion and choice. But again, the fact that autistic individuals have generally a number of co-occurring conditions, that has to be considered when thinking about medication choice and an informed conversation with your medical professionals.
So there's always a challenge when we talk about medications, that pills are hard to swallow. And that can be a huge challenge, for any child, for adults, like really for anyone, being able to swallow, you know, a pill can be very difficult. So a question is, if my child can't take medication orally, is there such thing as topical medicines? I know that there's liquid options, but what about like a topical? Is there such thing as that?
Yeah. Patches, transdermal patches, are made for a few medications, but honestly, they're not widely used. And any kind of creams, that might be compounded. I can't comment on that. I can only comment on what's FDA approved and commercially available in terms of prescriptions that you might get. So this is a really individual question. And I will just say, since we were talking about ADHD in the context of treating ADHD, there is a non-stimulant medication called clonidine that is used pretty frequently. And it's not just used for ADHD. It also works well for Tourette's and PTSD. And it can be a sedating medication as well, which a lot of people, if they take the pills, they tend to take it at nighttime. It comes in a patch. And so for some autistic individuals who are unable to take pills, sometimes that is an option. There's another non-stimulant drug, guanfacine, that works similarly to clonidine, but it is orally available, not as a patch. But that's one that I can think of that might be used by people in our community. And those two drugs were originally created as blood pressure medications, by the way. And so both of those medications decrease blood pressure. And so there's a significant amount of monitoring involved with those. If people have underlying heart problems, sometimes they will not be able to use those medications or stimulants. It just depends on what the problem is. And also, if you have low blood pressure at baseline, you probably won't be able to tolerate those drugs either. But again, this is nuanced and individual. But that's just one that I can think of offhand that would be useful. But talking about different oral formulations is important. Some medications actually can be absorbed in your mouth, in the buccal tissue. Buccal tissue is like your cheeks, and like if you tuck it in down here, like you're probably familiar with people that use nicotine gum to quit smoking. It's absorbed through the tissue in your mouth. And so we have this, like, what we tell people to chew it and then park it. You park it in your gums, right? Kind of like you would with tobacco, right? Like chewing tobacco, you park it in your gums, and it's the same with nicotine gum as a replacement. And so some medications are absorbed that way. So if you can get them in their mouth, like if it's a liquid or a tablet or something, like if you can get it in their mouth, it might be absorbed. But again, it depends on the medication that you're using, what the sublingual or buccal absorption would be. So that's one. Obviously, there's a lot of medications that are in oral solution, oral suspension, liquid formulations. And so sometimes those are a lot more accessible than tablets or capsules. And again, sometimes capsules, like I talked about last time, extended release capsules, a lot of them, you can open them up and put them on food or in food, and same with tablets, to make it more accessible. And so I would probably, in general, exhaust all of those options. And sometimes medication avoidance is just medication avoidance. And in PDA, sometimes it's PDA driven, right?
Yes.
It's demand avoidance. Taking medication is a demand. And sometimes it's just demand avoidance. Sometimes it's sensory avoidance. And sometimes it's something else. But these are avenues that you can explore.
Wow. Just like so much amazing information. And I'm so thankful that you would tell us all this stuff. And we're even more thankful that, you know, you have that understanding of PDA. And so you understand PDA medicine avoidance, because that, you know, that is a big thing that impacts us. And so this is just amazing information. I hope that this really encourages people to have very open conversations with their medical providers, but also talk to your pharmacist, like ask them questions and talk with them. And you know, even if you're buying cold medicine, you know, I know that if I stand in front of the cold medicine, you know, for like over a minute, you know, someone is checking on me, and I'm always like, no, no, I'll figure it out. and no, no more. I'll be like, yes, like help me out. And not be afraid to ask questions, you know, because you might not realize that you're taking Tylenol because, you know, you're not feeling good. And then you're taking that, I don't know what else, like you, maybe you're taking a NyQuil and you could be like overloading and have no knowledge of that. And so, talk to your pharmacist, ask questions. And
there's a reason they ask you, do you have any questions for the pharmacist? Would they take him up on the offer?
Yes. I'm always like, oh, I'm sorry. No, I don't want to take up your like, I don't deserve that. But yes.
But you deserve good care. Everyone deserves good care. And it yes. does mean that you have to advocate for yourself sometimes, a lot of the time, especially to get good care. But, you know, speaking from the heart of a medical professional, we're doing this because we want to help you. It's what we're there for.
Yes. So don't be afraid to visit with your pharmacist and ask questions and, you know, bring in your pill bottles to the pharmacy and, you know, if that's what you need to do. And, you know, I think it is important to realize that they, you know, your pharmacist is a person who is there to help you navigate all of this. And it's just been so fascinating and exciting to be able to talk to you. And I think these kind of conversations, you know, they help kind of break down the fear behind words like antipsychotic and, you know, and the confusion of like, well, why are you giving my kid a blood pressure medication? And so I'm so happy to have you with us and to like in our community.
Thank you, Carissa. That's really kind. And it was a pleasure to be here and talk about this.
Okay. Well, I guess we will wrap up. Thank you, Gina. I didn't get a chance to thank you. Again, all this wonderful information. If you are listening and you have, you would like more information about pathological demand avoidance, you can find it on our website at journeyswithpda.com. You can also email us at journeyswithpda@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram.